right.
A couple of announcements here. We're going to begin to resume a prep school first session on Sunday. And we also need to set up a schedule, a rotation. Prep school will be first session Sunday morning. And then second session, we'll need somebody, volunteers, to set with Tabor. Because I understand when you're 8 years old, this is a little much. And normally we don't have kids come out here until they're like 12 and they have some background. So hopefully we can get all that taken care of. So if you're interested in that, see Mary. She's going to have she'll make out the list, or Bill, either one, I guess. And secondly, we would like to get, to the extent you want us to have it, everybody's phone number, email, and contact information. If you have a cell phone and a home phone, contact information, just so if we, certainly, obviously, if we have a cancellation, you don't want to show up here and find out there's no class. So Mary has that list, the contact list, and if you want, I send out from time to time articles and things like that in addition to the notes. So if you want to be on that list, and it's not real regular, I probably don't send an article out, but every maybe once a month or something. It's not, I'm not going to deluge you with stuff. So if you want to be on that list, certainly let me know. You can send me an email at my address, Makarios, Ron, you probably got that part, makarios-online.org. That's my email address. So, or if you call me or text me on my cell phone, you can send me yours and I'll put it in either way. We want to update all that. So Mary has that list. Please see her about making sure all your contact information is up to date. Also, next week, this is Sunday 8/12, which is a week from today, there will be a church luncheon at the Blair House immediately following class. You just load up and head down there. If you're interested in bringing something, let Rich or Dina know. If not, you just want to come, that's fine too. We won't have somebody at the door taking up an offering, so you can... know that. So that'll be right after class next Sunday, a luncheon down there. All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship here. If something's gotten you upset, now's the time to deal with it. Make sure you're prepared to study, and let's resume here. We're dealing with this commands to Babylon's enemies to polish the arrows, that is, to make the military hardware what it should be, bring it up to snuff. Have it cleaned up and ready to go, analogous to upgrading missile systems and these types of things. Fill the quivers here. Again, looks to be the idea of get all the military might you need. You don't want to go at this halfway. And the Lord, do all this because the Lord has incited the kings of the Medes. Because his purpose is against Babylon to destroy it. And that's kind of where we're at in the text right now. In verse 11, the key there that introduces this reasoning, this thought, understanding. And as we wrapped up with verse 17 here, point 17, the noun is used in both positive and negative contexts, and the nature of the action must be determined by the context. But when the Lord's the subject of the verb, as he is here. It mostly deals with planning and executing various judgments on evil men or nations. In 18, the infinitive construct of the verb shakath, to ruin or destroy, should be understood in an epexegetical sense. That means the infinitive is used to clarify, explain, or qualify that previous noun purpose. And so, this is some of the maybe necessarily not fun parts of exegesis, but you've got to identify, these forms, especially the infinitive here, and how it's used, and what it means. So 18 or 19, rather, that verb is used to signify an act of ruthless destruction, subjecting the object to complete annihilation or decimating and corrupting it so thoroughly that its demise is certain. That comes again out of the Theological Dictionary, that definition of the Old Testament. And 20, the final portion of verse 11, begins with another explanatory use of the conjunction ki. That's the one translated as for. It is the vengeance of the Lord. Which defines God's desire to destroy America. That should be as an act of divine vengeance for the historical destruction of the temple in Jerusalem under the leadership of Nebuchadnezzar. And so one of the things you have to be careful with here is to not recognize the few points in here where there are historical references that have to be addressed. Because let's face it, the United States has not done anything to the temple in Israel. The temple in Israel hasn't existed since 70 AD. And so, but it will be rebuilt. Now, may the U.S. do something against that temple? I don't know. I don't know that there would be any reason to. We know there's going to be a third temple. We know it's going to be rebuilt. We don't know when. Again, if it starts going up any time while I'm still here, I'm going to be pretty excited. And but my thinking is it probably won't start until after the rapture, because that would be too big of a clue to the church age people. Maybe, I don't know, depends on how many of them are paying attention to it. But again, this goes back to the understanding, the revised understanding of the fig tree, that it relates to the restoration of the restoration of the temple, not to the nation at large. And so this gets into several factors, why certain things never worked. We had to address, if Israel was the fig tree, the Lord said that generation that saw it would not pass away. And a generation in the Bible, you cannot make an argument that a generation's much longer than 45, 46 years max. From the biblical numbers. Now, that doesn't mean other... And that, by the way, does not include in my calculations the antediluvians. I didn't include their ages as to what a generation might be. Because there is a tremendously different environment. And people were obviously living to old ages at that time. Much older. So the 40 years doesn't work. Well, then they wanted to stretch it to 50 to make a generation, then to 60, then a generation 70. Now it's 80 in some cases. No, well, it's not. And again, this also gets into the fundamental purpose of a sign. Why do you put a sign anywhere? And it's generally more proximate to what you're dealing with than a long, long way off. Again, you don't. If you're going north on 75, you're probably not going to see a sign bridge out in Georgia. Because, first, most people aren't maybe traveling that far even. But when you see the sign bridge out, you better start looking. It's probably close to where the bridge is out. And so the sign of the fig tree, the restoration of the temple, and that's clearly taught in Mark. You cannot miss it if you're honest about what's being said there. The literary structure of fig tree or temple, fig tree, temple, fig tree, temple is just, you can't miss it. And so when they see that temple going up, that's a sign for them, hey, the end is at hand. Once that temple's in place. So, here again, the idea is that God's going to destroy America for an act of vengeance on his temple. But we haven't done anything to the temple. So this does have some historical merit and reference that you have to consider in all of this. But once again, as I've said several times, although Babylon only gets judged in a particular generation, it's the whole entity that God's after. All that it's done throughout history. All the evil is going to come down on the final form of Babylon, the prophetic Babylon. Well, 21, the phrase, the vengeance of Yahweh, should be understood in the subjective sense of the vengeance Yahweh executes. The noun, nekama, there, vengeance, means to take vengeance, which is something that the Old Testament attributes to God in a positive way. Again, do not confuse vengeance with revenge. They are two different things. Revenge is vigilantism. Vengeance has to do with upholding law. Revenge seeks to circumvent the law. And so they are certainly different. Vengeance has to do with lawfulness, justice, and even salvation. The theme of vengeance has an important place in Old Testament theology, particularly in the prophetic writings. In 24, God's vengeance can be described as the punitive retribution of God. He acts as the sovereign king to execute the justice that has been so long denied. And the reality is, of course, God has allowed people, nations throughout history, to do various things to his people. This is also largely a part of their own negative volition. It wasn't as though they were innocent in this. But he has allowed all this, and he's going to make it all right, the things that they did. And just because, again, when we pointed out that God establishes a nation and says, okay, for instance, he told Israel clearly, Babylon is going to be the agent I'm going to use to judge you. There's just no doubt about it. They knew this. But did that give Babylon, just because God gives them this particular task to judge Israel, does that give them the right to do to Israel anything they want? And the answer is no. They still have to be cognizant, as it were, not that they were, but cognizant of God's directive will. What does he actually want? And he doesn't want them abusing their status over Israel. He gave them that status. But unfortunately, nations don't tend to think like that. He who is in power makes the rules. That's pretty much the way it goes. And that's the way nations tend to operate. So God's vengeance, again, he finally executes what's been denied. 25, God is specifically executing justice on Babylon because of his temple. In this case, the vengeance is to be taken because of the way Babylon has treated his temple. And 26, it should be clear that this is a reference to ancient Babylon under the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar, who conquered Jerusalem, plundered the temple, burned it down, and took the spoils back to Babylon. And in fact, he entered the temple on, probably him or his men, entered the temple, it appears, on three different occasions and took various articles out of the temple. The final time was the last one. But I believe it was in 605 B.C., somewhere around there, 597 B.C., and then finally the last one comes in 586 B.C. So 2 Kings 24. Ten through 13. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, and he and his mother and his servants. So, and his captain and his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in the eighth year of his reign. And he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house. And he cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. And then, of course, he led away into exile all Jerusalem. Now, this is the final one. This is in 586 when he finally does everything. But there's other forays into Israel and other moves against the temple that had happened previous to this. Also, 25, next chapter, 8 through 10. Now, on the seventh day of the fifth month, which is the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem. And I take that back. I think that previous one was a reference to a previous incursion by him, because this is the final destruction here. So all the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls of Jerusalem. And the rest of the people who were left in the city, deserted to the king of Babylon. And then the rest of them he carried away into exile. And then he describes in verses 13 through 17 all the different things that he took there. The bronze pillars in the house, the stands, the bronze sea. They broke to pieces and carried the bronze to Babylon. They took away the pots, the shovels, the snuffers, the spoons, all the bronze vessels. He took away the fire pans and the basins, what was fine gold and fine silver. The two pillars, the one sea and the stands on which Solomon had made for the house of the Lord. The bronze of all these vessels was beyond weight. And so obviously he pretty much did, as he was, what he was supposed to do. You can also see 2 Chronicles 36:7, another historical reference there. But Ezra 6:5, I think, just references this. This is when they're seeking to return, of course, now, under Ezra. Let the gold and the silver utensils of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, be returned and brought to their places in the temple of Jerusalem, and you shall put them in the house of God. So 27, what is evident from history is that the destruction of the temple cannot be attributed to the United States, since there's been no temple in Jerusalem during the entire history of America. And however, again, one must recognize that America does not have to be guilty of all the things that Babylon has done historically, done to others. When God judges Babylon, his judgment will fall on only a single generation. As we saw, the language in Revelation also is more expansive than you might expect, because it says that Babylon has done all these horrible things. And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all that have been slain on the earth. Well, not only in this incarnation of Babylon, Babylon throughout her history. And then, of course, Babylon finally gets it in the neck at the end of time. So 29, however, that does not rule out the possibility for some hostile American activity against the third temple once it's been rebuilt, either just before or during Daniel's 70th week. Again, I tend to lean towards after the rapture, but that does not rule out that it couldn't start before then. But what we do know is that in the book of Revelation, this clearly, if you buy the historical orthodox interpretation of this book, that the events recorded in Revelation 6 through 19 all belong to that period known as Daniel's 70th week, the final 7 years of human history as we know it, under the present regime, before we move into the age to come, under the Messianic rule. We do know now, however, that the temple has to be there, because we're seeing that it gets measured in Revelation 11. There was given to me a measuring rod like a staff. And someone said, get up and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it. And leave out the court which is outside the temple and do not measure it. For it has been given to the nations. And they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. And again, which part of that, it would seem to me that refers to the latter half under Antichrist specifically. But some interpreters, I think, apply this to the first half. But I think I tend to lean towards the latter half. And then the first half, of course, is seen under these two witnesses there. Well, 30 verse 12 serves as another good example here of the non-systematic nature of prophecy. The first part of the verse uses imperatives and speaks, there should be an and in there, and speaks of the time before the attack. While the last part of the verse uses Hebrew perfect verbs to speak of the destruction as a completed action. Lift up the signal. These are all commands, obviously, before the deal. Station sentries, place men in ambush. But then it talks about it as though it's already done, for what God has purposed and performed, what he has spoke concerning the inhabitants of Babylon. So the verse continues with four imperatives directed to the prophetic means, which are all to be construed with the initial prepositional phrase, against the walls of Babylon. That's why it leads off the phrase, the sentence here, because it governs all those that follow. Against the walls of Babylon, do this. Do this, and then do this, and do this. These imperatives should continue the pattern of the previous verse, and are masculine plurals which have been consistently used to address the enemies of Babylon. Well, it looks like I skipped one there. Sorry about that. 32. The translators of the Septuagint failed to understand the preposition L here had an adversative meaning. And they translate these imperatives as if they were a summons to Babylonians to defend the city. That's intriguing. Again, you might think, well, is there any merit to that? I can't find any place in here where the Babylonians are told to do anything except get prepared to be killed. That they are to embrace this destruction, as it were, because, or to get out. Obviously, they could avoid all of it. They're told to get out first. But I haven't seen anything that's really addressed to them. It's almost like they're passive in all of this. They're not doing anything, as it were. And certainly not doing anything in terms of defensive actions, of preparing for any kind of a battle. So again, these two imperatives, again, should be an S on there, continue the pattern. And again, this is addressed to the enemies of Babylon. So 34, the Hebrew term nace, standard, generally referred to a rallying point or standard, which drew people together for some common action, or for the communication of important information. Kyle and Delitzsch suggests that it point the direction, that it is to point the direction, while others see it as a signal to begin the attack. Again, the idea of the standard, lift up a signal, again, is the signal the rallying point to where they're supposed to do this, or is the signal now, here's the signal, time to attack. Do all this. And it appears, given what we're told later, station sentries and place men in ambush, that the signal is a command to assemble first. Now, obviously, it can be used later for something else, I suppose, after you've assembled that. Say, next time you see this flag, this is what you know. That's the signal to begin. So, again, others see it as a signal to begin the attack. The next two commands are similar in that the command to post a strong guard and station sentries. Both deal with the matter of observation. And in the ancient world, these commands meant that the place being attacked was to be kept under close observation. They don't want people, if you're going to besiege a city, you don't want people to get out and escape. You certainly wouldn't want them getting out and then creating any kind of retaliation against you, going and gaining allies or this or that. So the figure here, the picture is, again, of a city that's completely surrounded. That nobody's going in and nobody's going out. And the only difference here is, of course, as we know, during the first half of Daniel's 70th week, they will have a chance to actually get out. But the only reason I think you would leave is if you really believed all this. That if you really believe this is what's coming down, and this is the way it's going to go, and the nation's going to be destroyed. Well, then, you probably decide, yeah, it's time to go. So 36, most generally, this involved the reality of surrounding the object of attack, to make certain that nothing could get in or out of the place being besieged. In terms of today's world, point 37, these two commands deal with the matter of gathering intelligence in order to determine the optimum time to launch the attack. And again, because God's overseeing this, they're going to be blessed in this. They're going to figure this out, and it's going to work for them. So 38, Russia has traditionally been considered the nation that is most hostile to American national interests and has used its intelligence services to harm the interests of the United States. And of course, this is all in the news, as you know, Russian meddling. Did they get Trump elected? No, I can tell you why Trump got elected. The whole bunch of us wouldn't vote for Hillary. That's the only reason that I can really give you. It's because it was looked to be, who knows, how do you determine the lesser of the two evils when you deal with the American political system? It's all subterfuge, double talk, smear campaigns, abuse of authority, abuse of power. You've got all this going on all the time. And no matter what one guy says, I'm running on law and order. The other guy says, no, I'm running on law and order. He won't really give you law and order. I'll give you law and order. And of course, many of them, as we know now in our political system, they all run on the throw the bums out and let's start again. I'm not an insider, so vote for me. Yes, well, how well has that affected our system, our political system? Not that well. Despite these substantial political changes that have taken place in the world, several nations continue to expend significant resources to conduct intelligence operations against the United States. And in the past, these efforts were centered on producing intelligence concerning U.S. military. That was the first thing they're worried about, of course. And I've been watching this show. It's on, I think it's on Discovery, but I'm not sure. Cooper's Gold. You know, it keeps showing this round earth, which weirds me out. But, you know, because they'll have these shots from NASA of Cooper up there in his spacecraft going around the world. And they never did come clean on all of this, but what the upshot of this is, if I've watched it now, this is kind of into its second season. I don't know how long it's actually going to last, because they're treasure hunters. They're just trying to find... Because he observed in these shallow waters around the Caribbean these wrecks. He could see them well. And so he started writing down coordinates. He has this very detailed set of pages and maps that are designed. Now they're on the trail of this stuff, and guess what they're finding? Ancient wrecks from the 15, 16, 1700s. And if they find the right one, there's evidence that Sir Francis Drake and some of these people, that they left like millions and billions of dollars that were on these ships that went down. And so as I'm watching all of that, they never come right out and say it. But the implication is made pretty strongly, if any of you have seen this. And that is that Cooper was up there. They were really looking for Soviet nuclear installations. It's what they were doing. That he had this long-range equipment that allowed him to look for essentially a long-range sort of... what's that little thing you wave around on the beach to, you know, find stuff?
A metal detector,
yes, thank you. A metal detector. And so he had this, you know... But of course, they never come out and say all this. But the implications are that this had a military purpose first. Then, of course, the space race was going on then, and you had this sort of pseudo-patriotism, rah-rah, we're America, we're in space first, or we're going to get to the moon first, then all that. But, again, they do this all the time, and it and you see it even on the news. They will show you that a lot of these satellites up there are there for military purposes. Well, I saw just the other day, I said, look, the North Koreans may be back to their old tricks. Here's look at this installation here, and it has a very crisp satellite picture of it all. So that was primarily why these things are up there. Well, in the past, these efforts, again, were centered on producing intelligence concerning U.S. military capabilities, other national security activities, and military research and development. And that's the primary, I mean, that's primarily why you would want to do this, is to be able to keep up with your enemy and where they are and what they're doing. So Russia continues to collect this type of information. However, they have expanded their collection efforts to place additional emphasis on collecting scientific, technical, economic, and proprietary information. And indeed, these collection efforts are designed to promote the national welfare of other hostile nations and provide technologies required for the acquisition and maintenance of advanced military systems. So in general, point E, the national intelligence collection efforts of these nations has really diminished little since the end of the Cold War. But this is what the American people keep getting bombarded with. The Cold War is over. Oh, well, now we're worried about this. Oh, it seems like it's heating up again. I don't know. Well, should we be worried? Should we not be worried? And really, the American people are generally ditzy. And you can keep them easily entertained. I mean, the fact that anybody would watch American Idol or some of these shows still. And if you watch it, don't take offense. I only think you're an idiot. But no, I don't. I was kidding. But some of the stuff that passes for entertainment is hardly entertaining even. And the average Babylonian is more immersed in what's going on in the soap operas than he is in what's going on in national security. But... again, largely this is stuff that people either don't want to know or don't want to find out about. Well, traditionally the subject of information gathering by U.S. adversaries has focused on the following. Indication of U.S. military operations, foreign policy information, U.S. intelligence community weaknesses. That's obviously a good thing to exploit. The theft of military or dual-use technologies. And obtaining an understanding of U.S. national security and its military capabilities. Well, that's all real important if you're going to plan an attack. You really want to have this information. This type of information would be crucial to the success of any endeavor like this. So in the ancient world, point 39, these commands would also involve the prevention of sorties by Babylon. A sortie is an armed attack, especially one made from a place that was surrounded by enemy forces. So 40 here, the fourth command provides the culmination of the preparation, which involves placing enemy forces around the city in order to capture or kill anyone attempting to flee. And 41, in the case of the actual fulfillment, the language is just another way of saying there will not be anyone that escapes the U.S. once the attack is underway. The ambush will work to perfection, as it's supposed to, because God's blessing it. And that's sad when you have to hear the reality that God is against your nation. He's going to bless your enemies and he's going to blow you off the planet. This isn't what you can imagine. Why? Here's your good news for today. Why don't people want to go to doctrinal churches? Well, information like this, for one thing. Because this isn't, and we recognize it isn't pleasant. I don't know about you, but the study's been oppressive to me. It's all I can do some days to get up and even want to go to the study and say, oh God, more of the same. But I've got to get it done and get through it. So, praying about still where to go next. I blew off Lamentations. I can't take any more of this. I read that book two or three times and sat down and read through it. And I thought, there's like five chapters. And it's four chapters of gloom and doom and maybe one chapter of hope. And so I thought, no, I've had enough gloom and doom, I think. We'll look for somewhere else to study. Well, 42, the next statement indicates that the plan or purpose of the Lord has been executed. The perfective aspect of the verbs is another example of the prophetic perfect, which conveys the certainty of the plan and of its execution. That God is going to be 100% successful. And that's, of course, what makes the prophetic means 100% successful. God's blessing their efforts, where he's not necessarily blessing ours. One might imagine that God's not playing, as it were, we might say, both sides against the middle. He's not blessing Babylon saying, I'm going to bless our enemies too. He's making it very plain, I hate Babylon and I'm going to judge her and I'm removing her from history. This is all very plain. He is blessing, however, our enemies. But not because they're righteous, so people say, well, how could God do that? This is a Christian nation, is it? Really? Is it a Christian nation? And again, we've covered some of this historically and looked at, I believe there's a strong Christian influence from the early days of this nation. I also believe there was some strong evil present as well. And so again, the deal of dealing with Babylon historically is complex. It's not always just black and white or this way or that way. You have many things going on. And who knows what people are doing behind the scenes. And sometimes we can see what they're doing in front, scary enough. But what they're doing behind the scenes, we would have no idea. Well, 43 here, his purpose and the execution of that purpose deals with the inhabitants of prophetic Babylon. While one may focus on the leadership of the nation as the force that determines policies and courses of action, the reality is that the inhabitants of Babylon are, tie yourselves down here, are arrogant, spoiled, pampered, monetary reversionists who are more interested in money and the details of life than they are in God's plan. They're more interested in entertainment. Did you hear the catastrophe that happened? This deal, whatever it was, movie pass? Oh, you can't use your movie pass. Or they're going to increase the price of it. Well, that's awful. So, and there are people from whom going, and if you like going to the movies, I don't care. Don't take any of this personally. Going to the movies is a way of life for them. If they don't go see a movie once a week or so, they just don't think they're alive. And my time, but frankly, even when I have, and I've got movies recorded at home because they have, you know, sometimes I'll have these previews of HBO and other stuff. And I'll be, oh, maybe that looks interesting. And I'll sit down and try to watch it. And a lot of times I don't have time to invest two and a half hours in a movie. But that's just my niche. So that's nothing personal. Don't, you know, if you do, that's fine. Everybody's niche is not the same. But your average Babylonian is more worried about the next blockbuster than he is about what's about to land on his head. And so entertainment and this constant desire to be stimulated. Our nation is stimulated out of its mind. And we know that the people have gone nuts. That's just the reality of it. So, again, you have the government. They have their own, obviously, their own culpability in all this. Their own guilt. They have all that. But the citizens of Babylon, we're largely, sadly, getting what we want and getting what we deserve in terms of our political leadership. And for all the talk about change, what is the one thing I've seen in my 60-some years on the planet? Nothing changes. It is all just politics and business as usual. I don't see anything that indicates to me anything materially, substantially changes. Because all they do is get in a position of power, then they write rules and laws that are favorable to them and their party, or whoever they work for. And then in many cases, now there's a revolving door in the U.S. government between corporations. They'll come out of this corporation, get a job in the government, make policies and laws and all that, then go right back to their corporate job. And we're supposed to think this is great. No. But this is why we're told. Who are the great men of the earth? It's Babylon's merchants. Your merchants are the great powerful people of this planet. They're the ones that determine direction and policy and all of this. And again, we recognize capitalism. I hope we all recognize capitalism, a system that's preferable to about everything else. I'm not interested in socialism, communism, anarchism, pick your ism. The reality is this has provided an environment in which Babylonians have flourished. Now, sadly, unfortunately, they did not learn what everybody and every believer better learn. And that is, number one, God is the source of your prosperity. Now, you can go out and crank it up on your own. And people do that. They got to have it, and they'll get it. I know that. But God's the source of your prosperity. Whatever prosperity you have, you better be holding it like this. Not like this. You better be holding it with an open hand. Because it's God's to give, and it's His to take away. And so, the average idea of any Babylonian, that he should take a step back, make less money, this is just foreign to people. My God, no. You know, Babylonians are more inclined. We carry more credit card debt than just about any place on the planet. And we carry all kinds of other major debt. And being in debt, if you don't understand the Bible, let me spell this out. Being in debt is not good for anybody. And the Bible is against it. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have to have debt. None of us, how many of us have $200,000 or $300,000 laying around to go buy a house? Or $60,000 or $50,000 to go buy a car. You may have to finance things. We're not against that. What we are against is fiscal insanity that constantly makes this the issue rather than living within your means. If you're not living within your means and saving a little bit every month, you're not obeying your biblical mandates. Because you're supposed to be able to put aside a little in order to help others sometimes. You say, but I'm poor, I can't do that. You may just be not poor. You may just be not consistent enough in doing the things you're supposed to be doing, which involves some self-sacrifice. I've got a credit card. It's God's will for me to have it. That doesn't follow logically. You may have a credit card. It doesn't mean God wants you to spend yourself into debt with it. And this is something I've taught my congregation from day one, and I've practiced it. I don't just get up and say it. That I pay my bills off every month. I don't buy anything I can't afford. And in many cases, I'll wait a year, two. I'll stop and think and pray. I'm not in any huge hurry and often to grab for new things, even if I need one. Recently, our refrigerator went out, or at least the ice maker and water part of it did. And so rather than troubleshoot a 12-year-old refrigerator, I thought, well, okay, I'll get another. Well, God worked out a deal where I got a used refrigerator and all of that. Well, that's fine. It don't have to be brand new all the time. Yeah, but your house won't be in Better Homes and Gardens. I don't care. Doesn't matter to me. And so then, you know, we had this other deal worked out. We thought I had this dishwasher that was going to work, and found out because of my tolerances in the kitchen, they were so tight it wouldn't. Because it had a handle, so I had to go get a different dishwasher. And then I couldn't figure out how to get it in, so because the cord was in the way. I couldn't get the thing plugged back in. I could plug it in, but I couldn't shove it back into the thing. So somebody came by and said, hey, I can lay down. I can plug that in for you. And you don't have to be in any big hurry to lunge. Lunging gets you into trouble. And that's what most Babylonians do. Again, they're spoiled, they're pampered, they're arrogant. So 44 here, the leadership of the nation is often a reflection of the mentality of the citizens living in the nation. There are numerous doctrinal reasons for God's desire to destroy this entire nation. some of which have already been detailed in these prophecies. Some of his reasons include the constant manifestation of arrogance. How many times do we see these types of things? And in Isaiah 47 there, it was the spoiled, pampered princess who'd never done a day's work in her life and is suddenly humbled and going through, in that analogy, the destruction of her nation and her people. Jeremiah 47, 7 and 8. Isaiah 47, 7 and 8. And you said, I will be a queen forever. These things you did not consider, nor did you remember the outcome of them. Now then, hear this, you lover of luxury, who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am, and there is no one beside me. I will not sit as a widow, nor loathe the loss of children. And again, arrogance produces complacency. And that this idea of dwelling securely. Nothing can happen to me. This can never change. God will not let anything happen. You can also see Jeremiah there 50, 31, and 32. A false sense of security / complacency, and that comes out of arrogance. We just saw that, 47, 10. You felt secure in your wickedness. You feel complacent. You think nobody sees what you're doing. And yet God sees it all. Embracing the homosexual menace, as seen in the persistent references to Sodom and Gomorrah. See Isaiah 13, 19, Jeremiah 49, 18, and 50, 40. Now, we didn't reference Jeremiah 49, 18 because that's actually in the previous chapter. But I believe this deals with Edom. Yeah, this is prophetic Edom. And as we're going to see, prophetic Edom is also another code name for the United States. Like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah with its neighbors. This certainly emphasizes a complete and total destruction with no inhabitants. But why pick out that? Why not say just like the flood when I wipe the earth clean? And the fact is, every person here knows pretty much what the attitude and all in America is about queers and their ilk. Transgender people, oh gross. Deviant, demon-possessed weirdos. Unfortunately, that's what most of them are. They're certainly blasphemers at the highest level to suggest that God doesn't know the difference between a male soul and a female soul. Because he does. And that's the difference. The difference isn't just in our physiology, our bodies. He said, let us create man in our own image. Male and female, he created them. That's a reference to the soul, not the body. And so, God matches the right soul to the right body. Anybody that suggests that others are a blasphemer of the worst sort. This impudence, you might as well call God an idiot. He doesn't know what to do. So, the fact is, and we saw that in Romans 1, that great expose there on how all of this deteriorates. And one of the last things is even their women give up the natural use and become lesbians. And that's designed that even there is designed to draw your attention to this is really the opposite of what you would expect. Everybody knows men are dogs, for the most part, that the male of the species is more predatory sexually. But when women fall into the same sorts of vices that you don't expect of the fairer sex, you expect that they have more on the ball than that. But no, and in this case, because of the violations of doctrine, rejection of the truth, coming under the blackout of the soul, guess what? This all this deviant behavior comes right out of it. The absolute connection between your theology and your lifestyle. You cannot separate those two things. Your lifestyle reflects your theology, or lack thereof. So the persistent references to Sodom and Gomorrah, Isaiah 13, 19, 49, 18, and 50, 40. Anti-Semitism, we have not done right by the Jews overall. And some of these references are truly historical. But some of them get into what prophetic Babylon has done too. There, Isaiah 47, 6, Jeremiah 50, 33, and 51, 34 through 37. Materialism, of course, money and the details of life, that's what it's all about. That's the bottom line. And then political and economic internationalism, this idea of fornicating with other nations. using a sexual analogy to describe what from God's perspective is an illicit relationship. And it's illicit for us to promote internationalism. God's plan is nationalism, divine institution number 4. But again, under the major conspiracy of the last days, all the nations of the earth are conspiring to throw off God's restraints. So they don't want anything to do with God or His plan or His will, in fact. Which is sad, but it's the way it is. And again, when it gets to this matter of the conspiracy, yes, there is this big conspiracy going on among the nations. Again, led, no doubt, by a very small group of people. These oligarchs, they believe that only a few should rule over all. And their desire is to control the globe. You know who they share that with? Antichrist and Satan. Mm-hmm. Well, negative volition makes strange bedfellows, doesn't it? Or what you would expect. This they share with Satan's viewpoint. And Antichrist, he's as much like Satan as you could find in a human. He's more than happy to do Satan's will because he wants global domination. That's why I still believe Alexander is one of the best candidates. He was told there at the Oracle that he would one day rule the entire world. And he conquered most of the known world within about 9 or 10 years. It didn't take him forever. He was very quick. But he died this untimely death. They can't quite figure out. Nobody really knows why he died. Well, he's poisoned or what happened. That's still a mystery. Well, again, all these evidences here, all these charges are leveled against the nation, and it just complacently walks into the judgment, walks into the trap, and there it is. And 46, history has demonstrated that the people of this nation have become guilty of rejecting vast portions of the Word of God, but are guilty of encouraging and approving those who promote behaviors and lifestyles that pander to the old sin nature. And I watch even some of the things that are what I would just consider to be sort of a benign comedy. In many cases, these 30-minute sitcoms, all they pander to are the lowest common denominator. They always have, anymore, there's not one of them hardly that doesn't have a queer on it somewhere and as a role model. I don't want queers as role models for my kids. They cannot reproduce. They can only recruit. Where do you think they're going to shop? The next generation. That's where they're looking. And so, and then they're paraded around before us. I usually am watching the news between 12 and 1. And then right after 1, that comes on this show, The Chew, which is a cooking show and stuff. But one of the chief guys on there, one of the biggest fags you've ever seen in your life. Just disgusting, his behavior, bragging about him and his husband and how good they are. And what does this have to do with cooking? Why do we have to hear about your sexuality? I can melt butter without that. I can boil water without that. You know? So why do we have to hear about all this? Well, because they approve of these people and they encourage them. And then this vice list again, which is recorded here at the end of Romans 1, really begins in verse 28. But because people don't see fit to acknowledge God any longer. In other words, God has created the human mind, the irrational ability to reason and think logically. And guess what? They've violated all this. They said, well, we don't want that kind of a mind. We want a depraved mind. And God says, and he says, they don't want to acknowledge God any longer. So God gives them over to let them do what they want. He steps away from them. And of course, mankind deteriorates and the toilet that is humanity is about to be flushed. And it's going down. Because of these types of behaviors, and even worse, verse 32 there, and although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. They pat them on the back, they treat them like they're normal. When in fact they're deviants. But we can't say deviants anymore because we can't have any discernment. We're not allowed to discriminate. Discriminate's a dirty word. No, it's not. You discriminate all the time if you got any sense. I mean, do you just go out and buy the first car you see? Well, here's a car right here at the side of the road. You know, free for the taking. Okay, that's my car. Or do you shop? Do you do research? Do you think? Do you discriminate? Do you try to get something within your budget, or you just say, well, I just spend like a profligate and it doesn't matter? You know, just throw money at it and that'll solve all my problems. No, no, you stop and think. I mean, you do this even when you're shopping for groceries. Something that simple. You don't. When I go to get produce, I don't just grab what's there. I look over, is it ripe? Is it overripe? I saw the other day, I was out at Winn-Dixie shopping, and they had tomatoes marked down from $3 a pound to 99 cents. I wondered why. Wow, these look like good tomatoes. Well, they're all overripe. They were all just slightly getting close to where you had to eat them right away. So there's reasons for it. But again, I figured that out by looking at it. When I go to buy avocados, I try to see if they're ripe yet, you know. All that. I discriminate. And I assume everybody else here does too. And it's not a dirty word. And you're allowed to do it if you're going to think clearly. You have to do it, in fact. Okay, well, our time is gone. We will stop there and be ready to move on here Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship with other believers in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our growth and future glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.